Support for NPR podcasts comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Maybe Americans just do it differently. Republican members of Congress sat down with George Bush in the White House this week and told him that he must get results in Iraq or get out. But when you look at how Israel has now taken stock of its disastrous campaign in Lebanon last summer, America's muffled efforts at self-assessment over the profound failures of the Iraq War look something like pathetic. If little Israel can formally name names and lay blame right to the top, why can't we? Up next, On Point, the Israeli example and missing Iraq War accountability in the United States of America. We will speak to key players in our Iraq war drama and a former top Israeli official in this hour. But joining me first from Jerusalem is Stephen Erlanger, Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. Steve Erlanger, thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom.
It went by last week. There was so much news going on. It went by in a hurry. Give us a sense of just how scathing and thoroughgoing this initial report on the Lebanon campaign last summer was, Steve.
Well, it was very harsh. First, it is worth saying that it was Hezbollah that invaded Israel, not the other way around, to begin with.
Kidnapping Israeli soldiers, and that was the casus belli here, duly noted.
Right. I mean, they crossed into Israel and captured soldiers and killed others, and Israel responded. But the way it responded, and the fact that it took 34 days to come to a diplomatic conclusion that satisfies no one, was the subject of this harsh report. The Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert, had tried to avoid a state commission and instead thought he was lucky and was able to appoint this commission. But it was very, very harsh. It said Mr. Olmert himself was responsible for a severe failure in exercising judgment, responsibility, and prudence. It accused him and his government of deciding too hastily to go to war, neglecting to ask for detailed military plans, not consulting sufficiently, setting overambitious and unobtainable goals. And it's already produced the resignation of the chief of staff at the time, a general named Dan Halutz, and it has put Olmert's own position at great risk, and that of his defense minister, a man named Amir Peretz, who's actually from the Labor Party. So it's had a big impact here, and its reverberations are still being felt.
Point after point, page after page, and this is unvarnished language. I mean, it's right out there, as you say. All these add up to a serious failure in exercising judgment, responsibility, and prudence. They say, we impose primary responsibility for these failures, and they are outlined in detail, many, on the Prime Minister, the Minister of Defense, and the outgoing Chief of Staff. Who is this commission? In the Israeli system of government, who creates a commission like this, and how, where does it get the standing to be so tough, clear, precise, unlike the kind of mushy blue ribbon reports we often get?
Well, there's a tradition here of investigations after major national crises. There was the very important one after the 1973 war, which Israel nearly lost. And though it exonerated Golda Meir and the politicians at the time and excoriated the military, in fact, the pressure was so much that Golda Meir, even though she won an election following the report, then resigned. And there was another very important one in 1982 after Israel invaded Lebanon in a big way, and there was a massacre of Palestinians living in refugee camps in Lebanon by Israel's allies, its Christian Lebanese allies. And the commission found that Ariel Sharon, then the defense minister, bore at least indirect responsibility for that massacre, for not knowing that it would have happened and not being there to stop it. And he had to resign. In fact, he was banned from ever being defense minister again. That didn't mean he didn't become prime minister later. And those were state commissions, and they had actual power of law. When they said that Sharon had to resign as defense minister, he had to do that. This commission, though its findings were very harsh, had a slightly different legal aspect. Olmert wanted to avoid the force of a state commission and instead appointed a government commission. But these are five well-respected people, retired judges, law professors, retired generals, and they took testimony in camera, though some of it was published today, in fact, and they issued a report on the first 5 or 6 days of the war. There's a second part of the report to come out about the rest of the 28 or so days of the war, which may even be harsher and may urge Mr. Olmert to resign. It's not clear he'll be able to survive the second part of this report, but that's not expected to come out until later this summer.
Already this initial report, so tough, so thoroughgoing, naming names, pinning people by name, by role, by function, down to very detailed critique of what went wrong. Steve, describe for us the response in Israel in the streets and in the halls of power since this tough report came out.
Well, it's been actually quite interesting because Israelis knew the war was a failure in their own terms. So the report didn't actually tell them, you know, something big they didn't know. What it did was pin the responsibility with this adjective, severe failure, onto Olmert and his government, and it created a picture of some confusion. Now, the thing about Olmert is he's a wonderful politician, and he's built a parliamentary majority that's very solid, and since the war, he's been very unpopular, but his government is holding together because this coalition doesn't want new elections, which would bring the Likud and very possibly Benjamin Netanyahu back into power. So he's been protected by the fear his own government has of Benjamin Netanyahu. So his own party is held together, even though his own foreign minister, who's his second in command, has told him that he should resign. There was a big rally a few days after the report came out last Thursday in Tel Aviv, about 100,000 people of all political stripes who came out to try to urge the government to resign, and it was a very nice rally, but Olmert is sticking to his chair and saying, I'll fix what needs to be fixed. In the meantime, though, the defense minister, Amir Peretz of the Labor Party, is likely to be tossed out of his leadership job by his own party at the end of this month. So there's a debate about who's going to be the new Labor leader and who will be the new defense minister, and whether Labor itself can afford to stay inside a government that has been so tarnished and is so unpopular.
So for now, the head of state in Israel hanging in, though he has been well and thoroughly and formally critiqued in a way our president, for a different war, has not. Stephen Erlanger in Jerusalem, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Stephen Erlanger, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Joining me now from Washington is Kenneth Edelman. He was a member of the Pentagon Defense Policy Board that pushed for a war with Iraq, said it would be a cakewalk, a phrase he's come to regret. He was Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Ford administration and has become a deep critic of the Iraq war effort. Kenneth Edelman, thanks very much for being here.
Hello, Tom.
And joining us from Falls Church, Virginia, retired Army Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. He was Chief of Staff, Colin Powell's right-hand man at the State Department, 2002-05. He's a Vietnam War vet, former acting director at Marine Corps War College at Quantico, was at the heart of tensions over the Bush administration's road to war in Iraq, now teaches national security at William & Mary College. Lawrence Wilkerson, thank you for joining us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Ken Edelman, could we, should we do what Israel has done with this tough, tough, sharp critique of its Lebanon campaign? Should we, could we do the same with Iraq?
I don't think so. It's not in the American tradition, and in a sense, it's contrary to the American government. Israel and other parliamentary systems have a government that runs as long as there's confidence in the parliament itself. And when it loses a vote of confidence or something like that, then the government has to walk. And in contrast, the American system has a term, 4-year term. So to have a commission like this means that your finding about somebody who's going to be sticking around for a number of years. And you're kind of stuck with the president until the term ends. That's not to say, Tom, that there's no accountability. Because there's a lack of a commission like this doesn't mean that there's a lack of accountability in the United States. We have hearings. We have press, endless press insights. Mm. We have endless television commentaries. We have on-the-point discussions. Mm. And so there's lots of accountability. I mean, look at Bush's approval rating right now. That's a form of accountability.
It's a kind of accountability, but without the same crisp articulation. Lawrence Wilkerson, what about it? Have we seen sufficient accountability for what has gone wrong in Iraq?
I don't think so. And I think one of the things you have to do is examine, in the context of what you've been talking about this morning, you have to examine the difference between Israel and its relationship with the Israeli Defense Forces, its military, and America and its now modern relationship with its armed forces. They're quite different relationships. And as a citizen and as a former soldier for over 30 years, I'm alarmed by the developments in that relationship here, especially of late.
We're talking this hour about accountability and war. The Israeli example on Lebanon, American silence on Iraq formally. We're asking, when a war goes wrong, how does a nation formally take stock and put things right? We've been joined by retired Army Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. He was Colin Powell's right-hand man. He now teaches national security at William & Mary College. Kenneth Adelman is here. Said cakewalk about Iraq before, now calls it a debacle, has swung a big stick in policy circles for many, many years. Lawrence Wilkerson, you were saying that there's a different relationship with the military. Do you mean between the executive and the military, the people in the military? What?
On both counts, between the people in the military and Israel, let's face it, almost everyone in Israel is impacted by any form of war or conflict. And in many cases, almost everyone participates in one way or another. That's not true in this country. It's increasingly not true since we went to the volunteer military concept.
But does that mean we shouldn't be able to effectively critique our own nation's
strategic and military policy? It just means that we have incredibly less incentive and motivation to do so. Why should someone who is driving an SUV, making $250,000 a year, sitting on Wall Street, or whatever the equivalent, care about the socioeconomic conditions that produce our soldiers and put them in Iraq in harm's way?
You don't think these chickens come home to roost even for that fat and happy American in the SUV?
Well, they do eventually. You're seeing them come home to roost now. But take my war, Vietnam. The only time people really got energized over Vietnam was when the draft lottery, threatened to bring the congressman's son, the doctor's son, the lawyer's son, the Wall Street broker's son into that conflict. That's when America got really energized over the war in Vietnam.
But still, surely at a certain scale, I mean, you've said of the Iraq War, I think this is probably the worst ineptitude in governance, decision-making, and leadership I've seen in 50-plus years. Your words, that includes the Bay of Pigs, that includes, oh my God, Vietnam, that includes Iran-Contra, Watergate. That's a hell of a bill of particulars there.
It includes two administrations of Ulysses S. Grant that, to this point, mark the low point in corruption in American government. But my point is simply that you have to get the people motivated to do this kind of introspection, this kind of investigation. And until recently, and I'm still kind of alarmed that we don't have more rage in this country over this conflict, we simply haven't had people that were that energized over the incompetence of this administration as manifested in Iraq. Mm.
Ken Adelman, you've now called it a debacle. And I hear what you're saying, that there's a ton of talk about Iraq. There's media talk. We're talking about it right now. But when I read this Israeli preliminary report, I just came away my jaw dropped at the specificity, the particularity, the sharpness, the formal depth of this critique versus our kind of public bath of angst. I mean, we had the Baker Commission, but they look forward, not back. Do we need a kind of formal, point by point? Is there no way? Is it just elections that address that in this country with their, you know, bumper sticker slogan approach?
Let me answer you in 1 minute, Tom, and just tell you that I have a slight disagreement with you and with Lawrence.
Okay.
You said twice on the cakewalk. The cakewalk was an article that was designed and did address how difficult it would be to remove the government of the regime of Saddam Hussein. It was nothing about after that time. And so that's always a bum rap. And Lawrence, I guess I disagree, although I respect you very much and I thank you for your service to the country. It's been wonderful. I guess I disagree that people don't care. They certainly cared during Vietnam. They certainly cared in Iraq. You look at what people name as the problems of America today, and Iraq is at the top of this. Now, to your question, Tom, I don't believe it's possible in our system to have the kind of crisp, wonderful one commission that you're talking about. That does not mean that we can't have accountability. I thought that one of the worst days of this rather dismal administration was the day that the president wrapped around the Medal of Freedom to General Tommy Franks and Ambassador Jerry Bremer and CIA Director George Tenet, all three of whom I think did a terrible job, to tell you the truth. But you look at the number of books that were written already about Iraq, starting with George Packard's, and then, you know, with Woodward's book and with Cobra II and Fiasco. It's, you know, I've read about five or six. I'm sure Lawrence has read probably 12 or 15. And there is accountability in those. Now, the overall point is, in our system, things are just sloppier than in a parliamentary system. So we don't have one commission telling us, oh, here is the thing. We have lots of different avenues of information, but we have great openness, and in an ultimate sense, we have accountability.
I wonder if it's an effective kind of accountability. In 2004,
President
Bush said after his reelection in 2004, well, I guess we've had our accountability moment, or worse to that effect. And yet, I've seen nothing like this specificity. You know, lots of people in Washington lay it out. Yes,
well, then read some of these books, Tom.
Oh, I've read a lot of them, and we've had them right here on the show. But how do you, the old connect the dots question comes back. How do you connect the dots and get a different result? How do you change decision patterns so that going forward these things don't get repeated? We're talking here about what people are calling the greatest strategic disaster in U.S. history, and yet that defense, that Secretary of Defense stayed on forever and ever. Many people in the inner circle stayed on for a long time. Generals stayed on for a long, long time. Here's Israel within months after the Lebanon campaign fixing it. I mean, can we afford this sort of long, sloppy accountability as you described
it? Tom, let's finish your point. Israel, after this crisp, wonderful report that you love so much, has a prime minister who has, last time I looked, about 5% approval rating, which George Bush, you know, is heading towards, but would love the disapproval rating and the approval rating of George Bush, and he's staying in office. So, you know, you say, isn't this a wonderful example? It's not a great example at all. The whole government, everybody in Israel thinks he's doing a terrible job, and he's staying in office. The point here is that we have a term system, okay? We have a very different kind of system than a parliamentary system. And, you know, that's the way it's been for 200 plus years, and it served us overall very well. That is not to say there's no accountability. George Bush's historical reputation will certainly be held accountable, as will Cheney's, as will former Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, as will, you know, a whole bunch of people in this. But it's not done in the crisp way, and the crisp way that Israel's doing it isn't very effective anyway.
Well, we wonder. At least they've got it laid out formally in a way for all the public to see. Lawrence Wilkerson, what about it? Again, Ken Adelman says we have accountability of a different type. It's sloppy, but it's inexorable. Does it work on it? Do we have a cycle of accountability that is then effective, or does it take so long the way we do it with denial and propaganda and everything else in the meantime, you know, that we don't get the fix into our system that we may need if it's gone wrong?
Well, Ken's right in the sense that the tight democracy that Israel has that is very, very different both systematically and in terms of how the people participate in it than ours is, makes it a very different situation when you start talking about accountability, especially accountability at this level. That said, however, we have had, even in our system, we have had some significant accountability. Admiral Kimmel and General Short, for example, after Pearl Harbor, were, shall we say, held immediately accountable.
Mm-hmm.
We had accountability in World War II through George Marshall when he began to fire general officers and colonels and everybody else immediately as he discovered the old wood, so to speak, from the interwar years, was not going to be able to fight that war. We've had periods when we could achieve a degree of accountability that was much more precise and pointed than what we've achieved today. Part of this accountability problem we have today is this administration. It doesn't know how to affect accountability. It affects it in indirect means, like Jeffrey Miller, the general who went to Guantanamo and then to Iraq. He didn't move any further. Rick Sanchez, the general whose Peter principle incompetence screwed so many things up in Iraq. He didn't get his four-star Southern Command and go on any further. So we've had some accountability, but this administration doesn't know how to affect accountability, in my view.
Couldn't we do it better?
Lawrence is right.
I mean, the books you point to, many of them, this is one of their big points. Tom Ricks and others say our accountability flow itself has been stymied here. In the Pentagon, the executive, Congress.
Right. What Lawrence is saying is absolutely right. It is stems from the president. He is there for 4 years, and therefore he has to be hold people who work for him accountable. And that's very, very different from the kind of commission you're talking about, Tom, in Israel, where including the government leader is held accountable.
So if we have a president who's not doing that, but yet our national interests are no less urgent, what do we do?
You wait till the next term and you have to vote him out. And meanwhile, you just kick and scream. There are exceptions, as Lawrence pointed out very well, in those exceptions, but there are even exceptions in this administration. You had a wonderful report by former Senator Chuck Robb and Judge Larry Silberman on the failures of the intelligence community on weapons of mass destruction. It's 650 pages. I read it all, and it lays out what went wrong. Now, what it didn't do, unlike the Israeli example, and it is crisp and it is very, very sensible. What it didn't do, unlike the Israeli example, was name names and take it all the way to the top, or even take it above the CIA structure itself. That did not happen.
And here we have it in the Israeli report. Love it or not, it's just got a very different sound to it than what we see in the formal halls of power in this country right now. Let's go to callers.
I don't buy that, Tom.
Wow.
I just don't.
You show me a report that looks like this. I read the Baker Commission. I looked at Rob
the Baker
report.
Commission wasn't supposed to do something like that.
I've listened to the congressional testimony. I mean, this is point by point, in depth, right down to each of these decisions. You know, yes, in the private sector, we've got that going on, but can't we pull it a little closer if a president's not doing it?
No, I don't believe that we need to have that done in the public sector. That's the point I would say, Tom. You have basically a socialist government like Israel where things happen within a government. You have a basically unsocialist government like the United States when most of the action takes place outside of government, even the monitoring of government.
Well, we're good
our system.
But it may be, but the accountability sort of loop here and the time of it seems far from effective to me. Let's go to Ames, Iowa,
no, you
and
read
Nate.
George Packer's book? Or
I've read them all.
They came out early.
But where are the heads rolling? I mean, here's Anthony Zinni saying, what I don't understand is the bill of goods was sold here, yet heads haven't rolled. Where's the accountability? I mean, right on down.
Rumsfeld's not there anymore. Tommy Frank's not there anymore. Jerry Bremer's not there anymore.
Years after.
George Tenet's not there
years
anymore.
After. Let me go to Nate in Ames, Iowa. Nate, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking. I just got to make a point, and I'd love to take it off the air.
Yeah.
I think that for the general American public, you know, I live in the middle of the Corn Belt. I'm a younger college student.
Yeah.
I have lots of people I know that are in the military, and I support our troops 100%.
Great.
But I do not agree with the war we're in. And what I would like to see is just a general American public person is I would like to see somebody look at, did we go to the war on false pretenses, which I think we've all decided we have? And if we did, then was that avoidable or unavoidable? And then see some true accountability. I understand I've been listening to people saying there has been accountability, but there's been accountability for people that are involved with the government on a minute level, and they understand that there's small, what we look at is very small amounts of accountability. I would like to see somebody go all the way up. And if we can't get rid of people because we have terms, that's fine. You know, but I would love to have a job where, worst case scenario, my historical record is flawed. You know, he's still
right. But you're still on the job, and Nate. We've got it, Lawrence Wilkerson. You cite examples where accountability has been tougher and quicker. Ken Edelman says, "Well, yes, but that was driven by the executive, and if the executive has a different pace of accountability, we just have to live with it." Is that how you see it?
Well, I do think that that's a reality of our system. However, let me back up just a minute and say that I really do think that our founding fathers, Hamilton, Washington, Monroe, Madison, would all be astounded that over the course of our short history of the country, 200-plus years, we haven't used that little two or three lines in Article 2 of the Constitution more frequently, the impeachment clause. I do believe that they would have thought, had they been asked by you or whomever, at the time of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, do you think this will be exercised? They would have said, it certainly will. Every generation, they'll have to throw some bastard out.
Mm-hmm.
That's a form of accountability, too. It's ultimate accountability.
Is it appropriate to look at that in this case, of the greatest strategic debacle, you know, and so on?
The language in those two or three sentences about impeachment, which is nice and precise and concise, is high crimes and misdemeanors. You compare Bill Clinton's peccadilloes, for which articles of impeachment were introduced, to George Bush's high crimes and misdemeanors, or Dick Cheney's high crimes and misdemeanors, and I think they pale into insignificance.
Well, name a couple. What do you mean when you say high crimes and misdemeanors, then?
I do think that the caller was right. I think we went into this war for specious reasons. I think we went into this war not too much unlike the way we went into the Spanish-American War, with the Hearst Press essentially goading the American people and the leadership into war. That was a different time and a different culture and a different America. We're in a very different place today. And I think we essentially got goaded into this war through some of the same means.
Impeachment hasn't happened, may not be likely to happen. Shy of that, is there a way to tighten up our cycle of...
There is, and again, I find myself sitting back and wondering when the Congress was going to recognize the fact that it was a separate and equal branch of government, that it was bestowed by the Constitution with that separateness and that equality, and that it was supposed to exercise oversight of the executive branch in order to keep abuses of power from happening. And for several years there, until the Congress changed hands, and I'm still not impressed with its oversight capability, it simply abandoned that responsibility. There was no oversight.
There you go. Ken Edelman, the impeachment path, do you see that as a reasonable one here?
No, I think it's quite clear that the Founding Fathers had high crimes and misdemeanors, meaning Watergate kind of episodes. And
John Adams, great is the guilt of an unnecessary war, second president.
Right. I would like to say that while we're talking about accountability, right, and I think that Lawrence has very good points on this, Lawrence was chief of staff of the Secretary of State when we went into war.
Mm-hmm.
Where was the accountability that Colin Powell, who I think is a wonderful, wonderful man, and I've worked with him several times in my life, think the world of him. Where's the accountability that he should have, and Lawrence should have quit at that time if they thought there was false pretense?
Well, Lawrence Wilkerson, Ken Edelman says, all right, you want accountability? What about you and the Secretary of State, Colin Powell?
2 points there. First, I'll say succinctly, you would not have wanted to see the years 2001 to 2004 and early 2005 without Colin Powell. It would have been a disaster. We would have had no transatlantic relationship. We would have had a situation with Taiwan and China that would have been bitter at best and maybe even war at worst. We'd had a situation in India and Pakistan that it would have been tantamount to disaster. Colin Powell did damage control for 4 years. I put it this way. Colin Powell went to the Oval Office and cleaned the dog poop off the carpet almost every week.
But he also sat in the Security Council.
Second point. Yeah. Second point. I have grave reservations for my not having walked out in 2004 after the revelations about Abu Ghraib.
Hmm.
I kick myself in the butt. I have sleepless nights. I will admit that. I should have walked out. That was the thing that opened my eyes to the nature of this administration in more ways than any other. And subsequent to my having left the State Department in January 2005, I've done a lot of research in order to teach, and I have found things that truly alarm and concern me about the way we went to war that I simply did not know in 2002
such
and 2003, such as how I and the Secretary of State were essentially lied to at Langley when we prepared for his presentation at the United Nations in February of 2003. And that gives me grave concern. I'm now watching George Tenet go all over the television. I'm watching him give interviews, The Daily Show last night. I'm reading his book, and I'm finding that either George is lying, John McLaughlin is lying, Tyler Drumheller is lying, or someone else at the agency is lying, because they are not telling the truth about what they told the Secretary of State in those five, six night and days that we prepared him for his presentation at the U.N.
You've described what you call a kind of cabal between the Vice President Cheney and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, sort of working, I don't know if extra legal is the right word, but extra traditionally, certainly, outside the normal channels to put the war effort together. Now, if a government gets sewn together in a new way, its efforts get put together in a way that we're not, that is not traditional and is pushing, you know, beyond those channels, what do we do when it comes to accountability if that rests in the president's office?
But it's perfectly legal. I mean, you really have to go back to see the unprecedented power combination that Cheney and Rumsfeld had. You have to go back to Kissinger and Nixon, Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, all in the same man at one time. Kissinger sent memos to himself. We have the same kind of incredible, unprecedented accumulation of power in the vice president's office this time, and we had the cabal between him and Rumsfeld, and frankly, if you watch them sometimes, their body language, you didn't know who was the vice president and who was the Secretary of Defense. This is not something that's illegal, though. Mm-hmm. This is something that a president either tolerates or doesn't tolerate. Nixon, for reasons that we now know a lot more about through study and research, tolerated Kissinger's accumulation of power for various reasons. I'm sure that we'll find that President Bush tolerated Cheney's accumulation of power for various reasons, and Rumsfeld's too. So it's not something that's illegal, and it's not something that you can bring immediate accountability to, except for one reason. And David Rothkopf covers this in his book, Running the World, quite well. That which diminishes a president's power most markedly is failure. Well, we have had monumental failure in this administration, and so what we're seeing now is a diminishment of his power, and we're seeing the fact that the American people, however sloppily, to use Ken's word, this is done, are trying to bring accountability.
You say Colin Powell was cleaning up messes, but should he have left earlier anyway to ring the alarm bell if that's how he saw it, or to take responsibility if that's how he saw it for this strategic fiasco?
Well, I'm not going to put words in his mouth anymore because he's become angry with me for doing that. But I will say this. Had he left, it would have lasted a week, maybe a month at the most.
And the impact.
The media would have moved on to the latest escort scandal or whatever.
I don't believe that for a minute. I don't believe that, Lawrence. You know, I respect
very
much what you
say. Well,
you
don't know our system very well. Well, you just talked about it, but how can you say that our system has no way of immediate accountability and then say that Colin Powell's departure from the administration would have had an immediate effect on accountability?
Or long-term.
Okay, well, let me try.
Okay.
You can't disagree with what I haven't said yet.
Let's hear it.
But here's what I think, that if at the onset of going into Iraq, in early 2003, someone as prestigious, knowledgeable, and attractive as Colin Powell had said, Mr. President, you are the president. I am the Secretary of State. Secretary of State has to implement the president's views and policy. I am not very good at implementing policies I don't agree with, and I would like to do what Cyrus Vance did and what others have done in history and just resign as a policy matter. I think that would have put a great chilling effect on going into Iraq. Don't
Might
forget.
Have, but it wouldn't have stopped the war.
We hear the
Don't
disagreement
forget.
Right
Excuse
there.
Excuse me. Excuse me. Let me just finish. Don't forget, we had a majority of Democrats in the House and in the Senate voting for that resolution to go into war. We had 3/4 of the senators voting for that resolution to go into war. If Colin Powell, or even I would say Lawrence Wilkinson, had said this is a wrong thing to do, it would not have been a kind of unanimous, near unanimous kind of drive to go into Iraq.
Yep.
It would have created a stir in the press. It would have created a whole new impetus in the press which should be held accountable, to say, is the basis of this war entrance a good idea? In other words, is it right? Are there weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? And they would have unveiled all kinds of uncertainties, which Lawrence is reading about now, that are very nice to come out now, but not very helpful to come out now. There would have been a new investigation in all the things that we believe because there was no opposition to our beliefs. There could have been from Lawrence Wilkinson. Certainly there could have been from Colin Powell.
So we see that point of disagreement.
How would you suggest, Ken, that we do this when the DCI and the DDCI, Tenet McLaughlin, were arguing to the contrary, and they represent the intelligence community of the United States?
Very simple, because you have your own brain, and Colin certainly has his own brain, and say, I've seen the evidence that they're relying on their conclusions, and it looks pretty
good.
Excuse me, it looks pretty flimsy to me. Bob Woodward in his book says that during one of the briefings, even the president says, is that all you have on weapons of mass destruction? Doesn't seem very good to me. After that time, of course, he forgot that comment, and he went on, you know, on the road to war. But I think that piercing the veil of how much evidence you have is always totally legitimate. And we certainly did it in the Reagan administration. And you find out that, you know, there's all kinds of asterisks. There's all kinds of footnotes. There's all kinds of hesitation on the reliability of these things. You certainly would have found, Lawrence, that the biological weapons with this curveball guy was absolutely unreliable.
Gentlemen, with your permission, I want to put a stop to that one because we've got, I mean, it might have worked. It might not. An odd thing when we look at this whole span of accountability to pin it all on the kind of odd man out in this administration, Colin Powell. But I want to bring an Israeli voice in here for a moment, if I may. From Tel Aviv, Chuck Freilich is with us. He's former Deputy National Security Advisor in Israel from 2000 to 2005, now teaches political science at Tel Aviv and Hebrew universities. He's a senior fellow at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Chuck Freilich, thanks very much for joining us from Tel Aviv.
It's a pleasure.
Could you just for a moment, you were in Israel when this big report came out on the Lebanon campaign there. You know the United States well. Could we, should we have this kind of report in the United States, or is this a peculiarly Israeli exercise?
I think Ken Edelman made a very good point, which is that we're talking about very different kinds of systems. And Israel is a parliamentary system, unlike the American system, and so what is applicable to Israel isn't necessarily applicable to the U.S. I was quite surprised listening to the conversation till now to hear both of the speakers talking about the problem of accountability in the United States, because I don't think that there is any system in the world which provides greater accountability than the American system.
And what do you mean by that? Is it the totality of critique that Ken Edelman's pointing to that you mean?
Well, there's a bicameral Congress, which is a more powerful parliament than any other in the world, certainly far more than the Israeli system, more than the British system, more than any other parliament that I know of. And it's true that the oversight isn't perfect, and maybe not everyone is happy with the congressional role in the case of Iraq. But again, there is no other parliament in the world that has as much power as the U.S. Congress does.
In system, but in fact, does it look to your Israeli eye that the American government has been held fully and formally to account for what's happened in Iraq?
Well, what happened in Iraq was presented in this conversation till now as having been a total travesty. I don't want to get into that conversation, but I think a lot of loose rhetoric was mentioned.
Well, you can call it loose, but we're trying to take big lessons, and that kind of condemnation, that kind of assessment is all over the place now on both sides of that bicameral Congress you're talking about.
Yeah, but it's been simplified greatly. The people in the CIA and in the other parts of the administration weren't various evil bureaucrats just trying to mislead the American people. They were wrong. They were very wrong. The people in the Israeli defense system and the intelligence community were totally wrong here, too. People make bad mistakes sometimes, and in retrospect, it looks hard to explain. But these kind of things do happen, and it's not the first intelligence failure in history, unfortunately. The question is how you deal with it afterwards, and I think rehashing the same issue time and time again is not going to help the U.S. The U.S. does have the congressional system. It does have a tradition of blue-ribbon commissions, which have very often been very effective, have suggested a lot of wise changes in American policy. There was the 9/11 Commission. There's the GAO, the General Accountability Office. I don't think the American problem is a lack of accountability.
Boy, but we look right on down the list, and you call it too broad, but as citizens, we want it detailed. Kevin's calling from Fall River, Massachusetts. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hello, yes. I'm confused. The idea that this was an intelligence failure, I'm disturbed by that notion. It was fairly clear he had no serious weapons. We were put under the presumption that supposedly, the alternative was a cakewalk to overthrow the regime, or, waiting for the smoking gun in the form of a mushroom cloud.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is, so if we don't attack him, he's going to nuke us. But if we do attack him, we're going to have a cakewalk, and they're going to be throwing flowers on us.
Mm-hmm.
That's almost, it's like the big lie with Goebbels, the exact opposite of the truth. Who's most capable of using whatever weapons he's got? The person who's about to be attacked and eliminated, not the person who's not threatened. And yet we said if we don't attack him, we're going to be nuked.
So
but if we do attack them, it's going to be a cakewalk and flowers thrown on us, and we're going to be greeted as liberators.
But, Kevin, since then we've had a national election, congressional elections, book after book, article after article, hour after hour in the press. So have we got accountability?
Well, I think the thing is, right before the war, 70% of the population believed that he had the weapons and that he was behind 9/11. During the next congressional election, 30% of the people, no, the next presidential election, 30% of the population still believe that, and Bush won by 1%. Now that 70% of the population sees the truth, we see the results in the last congressional election. The key problem isn't the tactical issues of how the war was, implemented. If he did have the weapons and did threaten us, if he was behind al-Qaeda and the attack on us, then we wouldn't even be seeing our present predicament in Iraq as a problem.
Kevin, thanks for your call. Let me get one more. Isaac in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Isaac, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Just to piggyback on what the other caller just mentioned, a key moment is when the weapons inspectors were in Iraq and reporting back that they weren't finding anything. And that's the key moment that a lot of people gloss over, because the question there is, what was the hurry? We're not finding anything. The other thing I'd like to mention is that there's tons of outrage in the United States, but to my mind, it really comes down to who gets to tell the story. The story is out there. The majority of Americans are very, very upset about this, and that I think it's really a consequence of, in Israel, they're very often in a defensive position. But wars in the United States, at least lately, are wars of aggression that represent corporate interests. And it's very hard when those corporate interests are part and parcel of the media. The story really doesn't get told. But I would call the guests back to that moment when those weapons inspectors were calling back and saying, guys, we're not finding anything, and they're more or less cooperating.
Isaac, let me get one more call from John in Newport, Rhode Island. John, you're on the air.
Yeah, it's just a very brief comment about accountability and responsibility. Everyone is saying that certain people in the government aren't there anymore, and it sort of kind of seems to be working. The military has their own standards, and by way of example, I give you an aircraft carrier that may have a complement of 5,000 men. When the last guy in line does something wrong, and it's serious, they hold the captain responsible. No one seems to be holding Bush responsible. That's where it ultimately should lay.
But the country went to the voting booth in 2004 and reelected him. So does that mean he was assessed and judged and approved?
I don't think that he was fully assessed. I talked to a number of people that voted for him, and they said, well, maybe we shouldn't be switching leaders during the war. I think that there has been enough evidence that has come out. More and more keeps coming out every day, it seems, about what was going on, and he should be the one that's been held he should be the one to be held responsible.
John, we've got it. Lawrence Wilkerson, our time grows short here. Do you think we're finished with this at a formal kind of inquisition level? Is it all politics now? Or are we still at some point going to have to go back and look through all those books and have sort of the formal inquest into what happened here?
A lot of it's politics. I do think, though, that there are going to be a lot of people like me in the academic world and elsewhere who are going to be looking at this very hard, trying to figure out ways that we can recommend, suggest ways to fix the process, if there is some way to fix the process in the future. Interesting that you say the American people elected George Bush. Less than 1 in 4 elected George Bush. Because we don't exceed 50%, and when we do, barely, in presidential elections. And so when you compute the facts, you look at 1 in 4. One of the biggest problems we have in this country is people don't vote. 84% of the French people turned out for Sarkozy and Royale and others. We can't even produce 50% for a presidential election. That's part of our problem.
In the middle of a great big war, afraid we're out of time. Lawrence Wilkerson, former chief of staff to Colin Powell as Secretary of State, thank you for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Chuck Freilich, former deputy national security advisor in Israel, 2005. Chuck, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Ken Edelman has been there right through and with us today. Ken, thanks for joining.
Welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.